you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed.
You want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast brought to you by Edmonton Community Foundation. We bring you community discourse about amazing organizations and people who come together to make Edmonton strong. I'm Elizabeth Bonking.
And I'm Andrew Paul.
Happy Canada Day.
Happy Canada Day. We were posting this episode on July 1st, right in the heart of the year-long Canada 150 celebration. Canada's history goes back much farther than 150 years, but so far it has been a great year to reflect on what it means to be Canadian.
This is also a special episode for us because it's our 10th show. A bit of a milestone. And that seems like a good reason to say thanks.
We've been having a great time creating this podcast and are so grateful to all of you who take the time to listen.
It means a lot to us to be able to share these stories. So from the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
So on this month's episode, former Centennial Officer Bud Salome tells us what Canada 150 means to him. And we speak with Dr. John Weaver about the science behind conservation in the Bighorn backcountry of Alberta. But first, we're sitting down with Malcolm Azania, or as many know him, Minister Faust. Malcolm is a novelist, activist, podcaster, and contributing writer to High Level Lit. High Level Lit is a Canada 150 project being led by Edmonton Community Foundation in partnership with LitFest Alberta and 18 Bridges Magazine. The project features an anthology of original work from 12 writers reflecting on Canada 150 through an Edmonton lens. I sat down with Malcolm to chat about his contribution to High Level Lit and about an area of the city he fondly calls Cush to reflect the incredible African communities that live in the Boyle, McCully, and Alberta Avenue neighborhoods. Welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, Malcolm.
And thanks for having me on the podcast.
I would like to start chatting about your contribution to the High Level Lit anthology. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're writing?
You know, my family goes back to 1939 in Edmonton and 1910 in the province. And I've never written anything that you could call a creative nonfiction piece about my family. And one of my uncles, the last surviving member on my mother's side of the family of their generation, passed away in December. And I thought, you know, this would really be a good opportunity to make a tribute to my mother's family. And so my family moved to Edmonton in 1939. They were homesteaders in Green Court, which is near Athabasca. And they'd come from Missouri in the U.S. They were successful farmers here. And then, unfortunately, my grandfather passed away. And my grandfather had given my grandmother instructions, which sounds hilarious to call it that, but that's what it was. Because it was such a patriarchal time, he was worried that she would, you know, suitors would come in, take the farm away. It'd be like the end of the Odyssey. So he said, you know, get married as soon as possible, presumably to a worthwhile man. And that way the family legacy will be protected. And unfortunately, it was kind of like the Odyssey because a very bad man came in and sold off the farm, used the money to move the family to Edmonton and buy a very small candy factory. And for listeners who know where the Lois Hole mural is downtown on 95th Street and about 114th Avenue, that's approximately where the factory was.
So the neighborhood around where the candy factory used to be, you actually write quite extensively about that in your writing career,
right?
Including your 2011 novel, The Alchemist of Cush.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about where and what Cush is?
Sure. So Cush is named after the area of Northeast Africa that stretches from southern Egypt through what is now Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and Somalia. So it's the source of, you know, some of the world's, and arguably the world's oldest civilizations, classical African civilizations that have given the world a treasure trove of literature, religion, architecture, art, technology, science. This area is called Kush because it is the home of most of the cities, Ethiopian, Somali, Eritrean, Djiboutian, South Sudanese, Sudanese, and so forth, new Canadians. And that area has been growing since the 1980s. This is a beautiful area. It's full of, you know, food and clothing and culture and music and community organizations.
Do you think that maybe some people who are not familiar with the neighborhood might have a different view of what that city might look like?
I'll tell you a story. So recently I was, and I will not use the names to protect people's privacy, but I was working on a project. We were working at the Alberta Avenue Community Hall, and we were taking a supper break. And I was the only African-Canadian on the project. Everybody else was a Euro-Canadian. So the question came, where should people eat? So one of the people said, oh, well, you could eat at the Carrot. Or you could eat at the Portuguese place. And I thought, so you're in one of the cuisine centers of the city. You've got 10 times the access to Somali food that all of New York has. You've got Ethiopian restaurants. You've got a great Nigerian place. You've also got an excellent place, El Rancho. Outstanding food and a bunch of other places. You know, the folks that I was working with, evidently, they had blinders on. And I thought, what a loss for them that they missed this outstanding opportunity.
So over the years, a lot of resources have been devoted to doing the air quotes here, revitalizing some of these neighborhoods.
Right.
And I'm just kind of curious on your take, if some of those projects, are they revitalization or do some of them lean more towards gentrification? Maybe you could explain to our listeners what the difference between those two things are.
Revitalization, the word literally meaning to reinstall life. Gentrification means that the new construction and new businesses results in increased property values, which means higher property taxes, and often that the very people who've made the area a beautiful or exciting place can no longer afford to live there, whether they're homeowners or whether they're renters who now their rent's been gone up. Sometimes they're businesses. Gentrification, that's what that really ultimately means. Now, what I can say is that the city has done a beautiful job improving the road surface on 118th Avenue, the sidewalks, put in beautiful decorative lamps, and the festivals have made a big difference. But, you know, there's a lot of festivals. There's like the Deep Freeze Festival and there's other things.
Kaleido and...
That's right, yeah. So there's a lot of great stuff and lots of great activities happening at Alberta Avenue Community Hall. So there's a lot of great stuff in the neighborhood. From what I can tell, there's still lots of Cushitic, or that is to say, Northeast African businesses that are thriving there. And it looks like to me more. So I think that things are being handled well. And I know that some folks might feel like when I was a kid, the avenue that people, not the street that people got scared of, 97th Street. Can't go to 97th Street. You'll get killed. Or I don't know what people had in mind. It's really, really safe and peaceful. 118th Avenue, too. I mean, it's such a lovely place. Have dinner there. Enjoy yourself. Discover some new food. Go to the festivals. Bring your family. What, you know, Deep Freeze and Kaleido Festival, these are family affairs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, mm-hmm. So.
Another checkpoint on the road to gentrification often does actually have to do with the arts community and artists moving in and starting whatever they do, their initiatives, right. Their artwork, and then attracting new people into the neighborhood, start buying property. And I think that my wife and I actually fit into this kind of category.
Right.
So we did buy a house, and the garage and backyard were unsafe. So we did renovate. It really did change the look of the corner. And I just wonder if you had any thoughts on what might be some of the responsibilities of property owners in these neighborhoods that are moving in.
Thank you so much for discussing rights in terms of responsibilities. You know, nobody wants to live in a dump or what some people consider a slum. And when houses are run down, it's not like the people who live there want their homes or their neighborhood to be run down. When any of us, we have power, and, you know, wealth is power, access to community foundations, government, media, and so forth, they all come with power. The question is, how do we use it in a way that adds value to the people who live around us and near us, and even, of course, to people who don't live near us but are affected by our actions? On an everyday basis, one of the simplest things is, it sounds like what you're already doing, which is you shop in the neighborhood. You support those businesses. Why drive across town? I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't be allowed to enjoy the Keg, Earls, and Moxie's. And all. Like, if you like those, that's fine. But right in your neighborhood, there are places, you know, supporting local business, that's going to make your neighborhood better. A lot of mom-and-pop restaurants, they don't look sharp, you know. They're running at a deficit. They're struggling. They're trying to become viable. The more customers they get, the more they fix up their restaurants, the better the outside and inside looks, the better the whole neighborhood looks. And that's a psychologically protective effect for everybody, because when things look like they're well taken care of, people who want to cause trouble are more worried they'll be caught. So they're less likely to cause trouble.
Mm-hmm.
However, everybody can just buy stuff. That's easy. But people who are connected through, as I said, media, government, corporations, other businesses, foundations, and so forth, they have social capital. They feel comfortable going to meetings, talking to power brokers at levels of government, talking to investors.
Right.
And they can say, look, we need local policies that benefit this neighborhood and that don't chase out existing residents. And I'm so glad you raised the question of social housing and affordable housing, because Edmonton, if you grew up here, it's not clear to you how much of the world isn't like Edmonton, you know? And in a lot of places, it's just nonstop either terribly impoverished folks who, like, have lousy social services and urban amenities, and then nothing but intense wealth. And I mean, as an example, try visiting almost any city in the United States. It's weird. I took my family to San Diego a few years ago, and we just want to take our kids to go to a park, which in Edmonton is just standard. Hey, let's go find a park. And to us, park means playground, as yep. Edmontonians, right? So we couldn't find a playground. All the playgrounds that we saw were fenced off. Like, I mean, like locked. They were parts of schools and stuff. And it's like, what? So you can't just go to the... Nope. So we have an attitude in Edmonton about there should be people of all economic classes living near each other, which is one of the best ways to ensure social cohesion. It's one of the ways that you prevent schools from becoming have-not schools. Now, of course, you know, you're still going to have disparities. They're ameliorated. We have a smaller range from have-not to have schools than you would have in the United States.
Right.
Which is kind of like the poster child for wide disparity and giant wealth gap. So you can advocate for policies that ensure that neighborhoods will be well taken care of. Advocate, for instance, for community policing. It was a couple decades ago in Edmonton that we had a lot of community policing, these small little shops, police on patrol on foot.
Yep.
There's a big difference when you, including for people who have reason in North America to fear the police, and I'm talking about racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
But also economic profiling, because lots of poor white people are the victims of police brutality and even killing. And if you don't believe that, just look it up online and you'll see a lot of these videos, right? So when you know the police, man, woman, or other gender, who's coming in your neighborhood, and that person gets to know you, that's the police who now is in a position to get information to bust the people who are really terrorizing the people of the neighborhood.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to chat about that maybe we haven't touched upon about the neighborhood?
I guess the big thing is, yes, it's fun to fly to other places, but all you have to do is get on your bicycle and explore this magnificent city that we have that has a range of culture and cuisine and art and people that should be the envy of the country. But Edmontonians, I love this city, and I love the neighborhood of Cush. But one thing that we're really bad at is bragging. We do not let people know about how beautiful a place is that we live. We don't let them know that our North Saskatchewan River Valley is a park 51 times bigger than Central Park, way bigger than Stanley Park. And so we are a magnificent community. You can get your plane ticket if you want. Get on your bike, take the bus, drive down, enjoy yourself. You will find another part of Edmonton that you didn't know about before that you will love. Fall in love.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Many thanks to Malcolm Azania for sitting down with us. His novel, The Alchemist of Cush, was just reprinted by Resurrection Books. So you can request it from your local bookstore or find it on his website at www.ministerfaust.com. You can also subscribe to his podcast, MF Galaxy, on iTunes, and we'll be sure to post a link on our website. We should also mention that the next High Level Lit Salon is on September 6th, right here at Edmonton Community Foundation's beautiful River Valley office. The event will feature Paula Simons, Myrna Kostash, and Richard Van Camp. What's next, Elizabeth?
Bud Salome and his family have been dedicated to Edmonton's community for many years. Since 1999, the Bud and Laverna Salome Family Fund has provided funding to a huge variety of organizations here in Edmonton. He is also a former Centennial officer. He joined us to share his thoughts about Canada 150. Hi, we're here today with Bud Salome, who was a Centennial officer back in 1967. So he's here to talk a little bit about Canada's 150th and the differences between the Centennial and the Sesquicentennial. So tell us a little bit about what your job was like in 1967.
Well, in 67, it seemed to be a lot of excitement about our 100th anniversary, and people were embracing the idea of Canada and our centennial and come up with a lot of wonderful projects to mark the occasion. I was involved in probably 100 workshops around the province where people got together and came up with projects that they might do on their own community. We saw the UFO landing pad in St. Paul, for example. We saw a new Canadian who lived in Stettler who hooked a rug 9 by 12 with the Canadian coat of arms in the center and the provincial coat of arms around it. It was just a spectacular rug. We saw a farmer from Pibroch, Alberta, who had carved the heads of the then 17 prime ministers of Canada, mounted on a pedestal in a Christmas tree shape. The Voyageur canoe pageant, which united Canadians from Rocky Mountain House to Expo, where canoes from each of the provinces were competed in a part race, part pageant. And the communities that these paddlers stopped in generated a lot of enthusiasm. They had barbecues and dances and all kinds of good things going on.
Let's talk a little bit about the Voyageur Canoe Pageant. This year there will be a Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade, which is similar and sort of repeating history a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, there's the Canoe Brigade in Edmonton, Devon to Edmonton kind of thing, but this race is starting in Rocky Mountain House. It's a 1,600-kilometer race from Rocky Mountain House to the Paw in Manitoba. And as I understand it, there's going to be 6 to 8 canoes. These are six-man canoes, by the way. The whole team is going to be made up to 12 people, but each team only has 6 paddlers in the canoe at one time. This year, one of the paddlers that has to be in the canoe at all times is a female.
So that's one of the changes that you see definitely from the centennial is there's more female involvement?
I don't see the same excitement for 150 as we had in 67. But, well, I think everybody's, I mean, in my own case, I'm so damn happy that my grandparents chose Canada to emigrate to that I'm very thankful and very grateful.
I think I'm in the same boat. My father chose Canada to immigrate. And I think most Canadians are in that boat, unless you are part of our First Nations people. That's a wonderful sentiment to start off Canada Day with.
Yes.
Are you looking forward to anything this coming Canada Day? Are you going to be out at the fireworks? What are your plans?
Well, actually, I'm going to Rocky Mountain House for the start of the canoe race. So I'll be there on July the 1st.
What is something that you learned while you were a centennial officer that you still carry with you?
The fact that this is the greatest country in the world. I'm glad I'm here. There's so much diversity and so much, well, feeling about being Canadian. That's what I learned. So my personal projects, that's one of them that I'm pointing at now.
And you handed Lisa, our producer, and I a pack of cards. So do you want to talk about that?
Well, this was a family project that my daughter and son and I got together on, and the card reads 1867, 2017, Canadian flag, and it says, "Thank you, Canada, for being a great country to live, to work, and to play." So that's my sentiments and why we produced those decks of cards. But I also went to Prince Rupert on Sunday and went up to the Grizzly Bear Sanctuary, and I'm going on an Arctic cruise starting on August the 5th, go to Ellesmere Island, Baffin Island, and go over the spot where they found one of Franklin's ships. So there's so many things in Canada that I haven't seen yet. The time I got left, I got a lot of things on the bucket list.
And that's what you plan to do, is see more of Canada.
That's what I'm planning to do, yes. So anyway, I would hope that Canadians think about Canada and think about going to places in Canada that they haven't been before, and going to some of our national parks where the generous prime minister gave everybody a free pass. Well, I just hope that they will see more of our great country.
And thanks so much for sharing all of your thoughts with us, and I hope you do get to see all of the things on your bucket list this year.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Bud Salome for joining us. It was great to connect with him over Canada's history.
The Bighorn Backcountry is an important wildland region here in Alberta, but it doesn't have conservation protection. Three groups, including Yellowstone to Yukon, Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, and Wildlife Conservation Society, are collaborating to secure conservation. Dr. John Weaver.
I'm Dr. John Weaver. I'm a senior conservation scientist for the Wildlife Conservation Society of Canada.
Recently published a scientific report titled Bighorn Backcountry of Alberta, Protecting Vulnerable Wildlife and Precious Water. He spoke with Lisa about why we should be paying careful attention to this wildland.
Well, hi, John. Thank you so much for joining us on the Well Endowed podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you. We are an organization that is dedicated to conserving wildlife and wildlands all across Canada.
What are some of the key challenges facing the conservation effort in this area?
I would say over the last 100 years, conservationists have been primarily concerned with what's called the ever-expanding footprint of industrialized society. You know, we all need resources, and those come at somewhat of a cost to the natural world. And so that's kind of been the challenge over the last 100 years. But going forward, the new challenge, along with the past challenge, is climate change, especially the warming and drying nature of the climate change. It is upon us already. We just passed the threshold of 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide emissions, and it's already having consequences to the waters, to the wildlife, to human communities in the Arctic, for example. And so that's our challenge going forward, and a lot of it's going to be centered around the issue of water, water supply, the timing of water release.
And that's a really big deal, especially for us Edmontonians, if we want to take a selfish perspective, because this is where our headwaters are. Is that correct?
Oh, exactly. You know, North Saskatchewan River flows, of course, right through Edmonton. But if you think of it like a tree with a canopy of branches, let's think about it as a blue tree. That canopy of branches is up in the Bighorn. You have the Brazeau River coming in and the Blackstone just north of the North Saskatchewan River. Going south, you have the Ram River, the Clearwater. If you look at it on a map, it's just this blue canopy of your headwaters. Although it starts up in the glaciated regions of Banff National Park, almost 86% of the water yield for the North Saskatchewan River comes from that section that's known as the Bighorn Backcountry.
Why do you think it's important to focus specifically on this area as a zone for conservation?
Yeah, so, you know, when you think about it, it is sandwiched in between these two national parks on the Alberta side, Jasper and Banff, that are, you know, world-acclaimed national parks. People come from all over the world, of course, to see these national parks. And here you have this area just to the east that shares the very same spectacular terrain and natural features, and it also shares the wildlife. These wildlife don't recognize political boundaries or jurisdictional boundaries. So it's important to take the larger landscape view and make sure that we're managing at the right scale. We've already talked a little bit about it being the headwaters for North Saskatchewan River. And I think the third thing is that, you know, with the climate changing as it is, we're going to have to find options for resiliency going forward. We need options. Plants and animals need options. And when you have a mountainous landscape like the Bighorn Backcountry, where you have a range of elevation from the river valleys all the way up to the alpine peaks, you have a lot of different aspects, south-facing, north-facing. All of that helps to create a lot of different micro kinds of habitats. And so from that perspective, it's kind of an investment in the future for both the plants and animals and also for ourselves.
As part of your report, you focused on a suite of wildlife and features, water being one of the features. But
yes.
Why was it important to pick the suite?
We focused on a suite of species that includes grizzly bears, wolverines, bighorn sheep, and a fish called bull trout. We selected a suite of species because they each have different requirements. All of them are quite vulnerable. Several of them are already listed on either a provincial list or a national list. And as a group, they can perhaps serve as an umbrella for all the other species that occur out there, which is just not feasible to examine each and every one.
Your report synthesized research from several different scientists.
Yeah.
What are you hoping to achieve with bringing all of this data together?
Sometimes in the research world, a lot of great research gets done and it gets published, but it's not always brought out to the general public in a way that can, you know, inform public discussions and ultimately decisions about different issues. And so this is kind of a made in Alberta report, because all the data comes from Alberta biologists. My task was simply to try to synthesize it in an interesting way, put it into a map format so you can visually digest the information, and then see where that leads us from a science perspective. And in this case, much of the Bighorn Backcountry area is so vital for the reasons that we've been discussing. And we came up with a recommendation for a wildland provincial park.
The research was also part of a larger collaboration with the Yellowstone to Yukon initiative and also with the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, CPAWS. The collaboration is to protect the bighorn. How important is it, do you think, working in partnership to succeed with the overall project?
Oh, I think it's absolutely essential because, you know, each organization has a different role to fulfill. We at WCS Canada fulfill the role of trying to bring to that discussion best available science and interpretation of that science. And the other groups have the skills and the network of taking that into the public policy arena and working with local people and providing leadership for this important issue. So we've been glad to be part of that larger team. We've been very careful to maintain our scientific independence, but it's nice to be part of the larger team and bring that forward into the discussion.
What are the next steps now that the report is out?
So I think the other groups will push the campaign forward and enter into that public dialogue, and we'll see where that goes.
Before we close, is there anything that you wanted to touch on that we didn't get to in our discussion here?
You know, the world is rapidly changing in terms of human population, our industrial effects on nature, and the ecosystems that of which we are a part and that provide services to us almost for free. Here's an area in the Bighorn that just embodies all of that. It is providing ecosystem services. It's providing that all essential and exquisite water resource. I would just say let's wake up to the importance of that and the beauty of that. Hopefully we can move forward as a wise society.
Thanks very much to Dr. Weaver for sharing his work on Bighorn Backcountry Region and for telling us why he recommends the land to be designated as Wildland Provincial Park.
If you'd like to find out more about the region and how you can help protect it, visit our website. We'll have the link to Dr. Weaver's report and to the organizations collaborating to protect this area. We're nearing the end of our show, which means...
news time!
You bet. Now, many of you have already heard the big news.
What are you talking about? What is the big news?
Well, the big news is that we were finally able to name Eldon and Ann Foote as the donors of the largest charitable gift to a community foundation in Edmonton's history.
How much was that worth?
$164 million. So it is pretty incredible.
That is pretty incredible. So what does that mean to the Community Foundation?
So for Edmonton Community Foundation, that means that over the last number of years, we've been able to grant about $43 million to hundreds of charities in various sectors across the city. And that is just an amount from the Eldon and Ann Foote Fund.
Wow, $43 million. That's a lot. So what does that mean going forward?
Well, it kind of just means that that's the start. Since this is an endowment fund, it's going to continue to grow and give to more and more charities in perpetuity. So that is pretty awesome. And Edmonton is very lucky to have generous donors like the Foots.
That is amazing. Thanks to Eldon and Ann Foote for contributing so much to our community.
We also want to remind you about our Takei for Two contest. You could win two free VIP tickets to see George Takei live at the Shaw Conference Center on November 29th.
To enter, tweet or share our podcast on Facebook using the hashtag #TheWellEndowedPodcast. We'll announce the winner on our November 1st episode.
Each month, we like to keep you in the loop about upcoming deadlines for grant applications. Take a listen to see if you or someone you know might be eligible to apply for funding.
First up is the Charmaine Letourneau Scholarships. These are for Alberta students who are deaf or hard of hearing, and the size and the number of awards will vary. Applications are due by August 31st.
Next, we have the Al Mar Awards. These awards range from $500 to $2,000 for public service employees working in Edmonton. These employees must demonstrate excellence and long-term commitment to their profession. Deadline to apply is August 31st.
And the last is the upcoming deadline for community grants. These grants are for registered charities in Greater Edmonton area and can be up to $40,000. The deadline to apply is September 1st for funding, required after December 1st.
And that brings us to the end of the July edition of the Well Endowed Podcast. Thanks to each of our guests for sharing their time with us.
And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed it. And if you did, please be sure to share the podcast with your friends and subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play. We've been your hosts, Elizabeth Bonkink
and Andrew Paul. Until next time.
The Well Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation
and edited by Lisa Pruden.
You can visit our website at wellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
And follow us on Twitter at @TheECF.
Our theme music was created by Octavo Productions.
Check them out at octavoproductions.com.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.
Well Endowed.